All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome everyone to this session. The title of the session, to make sure you're in the right room, is Slippery Treasures, Affinity Fraud in Mormon, Utah. And I've been talking up here with Kenneth and Nadine a little bit, and we're in for some interesting stories, I imagine. Let me give you a little bit of biographical information about Kenneth and Nadine, and then we'll go ahead and move into their presentation. But before I do that, please, as a reminder, turn off your cell phones if you have them turned on, or put them on silent so we don't interrupt them. And we'll save, I believe, the last 10 minutes or so for Q&A at the end is what we're aiming for. So Kenneth Lauji has a BA in history from BYU, a JD from the University of Oregon School of Law, and an MA in history from the University of Utah. He's been an adjunct professor in history at Salt Lake Community College for 10 years and is one of its highest-rated history professors. He's practiced law at Siegfried & Jensen in Salt Lake City. He's still there. And is the author of Pie in the Sky, How Joe Hill's Lawyers Lost His Case, Got Him Shot, and Were Disbarred. That was published in 2011, so that's a pretty recent book. And then we also have Nadine Hansen here. Nadine will be responding to Kenneth. And Nadine is a mostly retired attorney living in Cedar City. To the extent that she is not retired, she represents children as a guardian ad litem in custody disputes. In her spare time, she raises vegetables and chickens. Kenneth.
Thank you. I wanted to start today by a story. It comes from Roughing It by Mark Twain. In 1861, he went west for the first time. He was running away from the Civil War. He failed as a Nevada silver miner, and he turned to writing. He claimed that he was merely entertaining, but he tells a story that tells us a lot about Utah. He tells a story about this Mr. Street. And in the early 1860s, they were putting the transcontinental telegraph line, which, of course, ran through Utah. And Mr. Street had contracted to build a section, and he had subcontracted with a bunch of Mormons. And this was his worst difficulty, for which he had not accounted. These Mormons dumped the poles, trashed the wire, and went home. And he went to them, said, "You got a contract," and said they would admire to see a Gentile force a Mormon to fulfill a losing contract in Utah. And to make everything worse, they made fun of him. And he thought this was really odd. He went to everybody he could find in town, in Salt Lake City, to see if anybody could help him. And finally, one Gentile said, "Oh, quit fooling around with the small fry. Go see Brigham Young." And Mr. Street said, "I can't figure out what a preacher in the tabernacle could do in this situation, but I thought he might give me a hint or two." And so he went straight, and he said, "Bring me on." He sat there and listened, didn't ask me questions at first, and then he questioned him as to the details of the contract. Then Brigham Young made a list of the contractors' names. He said, "Mr. Street, this is all perfectly plain. These contracts are strictly and legally drawn. They're duly signed and certified. These men manifestly entered into them with their eyes open. I see no fault or flaw." Brigham Young then told his attendant, gave him the list of names, and said, "I want these men in my office at 10 o'clock in the morning." And when they showed up, Mr. Street was there. He said, "Did you sign these contracts with your eyes open?" They said, "Yes." He said, "Go fulfill them if it makes you paupers." Mr. Street thereafter records that the Mormons were strung out across the deserts working like bees, and he never heard another word of complaint out of them. Now, Mr. Street, Mark Twain is making fun of everyone, but Mr. Street illustrates the dangers, the perils of doing business in a closed society, where ethics are not determined by law, but by resort to religious authority. And the refusal to keep agreements until Brigham Young ordered them to is a form of affinity fraud. Affinity fraud can be defined for the purposes of our discussion as a deviation from normal business ethics based upon self-identification in a closed group. Sometimes it's investment fraud. In Mark Twain's case, it's just an ordinary example of taking advantage of people outside of the group. And in Utah, we find examples of investment fraud. We find examples of ordinary fraud perpetrated by Mormons on the non-Mormon community. Sometimes we see these frauds perpetrated as part of a gospel of wealth, where if you live righteously, you're supposed to get rich. But we also find suspensions of disbelief when political and legal positions are articulated by members outside of the Mormon faith. We find willful suspension of disbelief in stories told by Mormon leaders. We find people who believe that they can achieve great knowledge not by studying accredited universities, but by elsewhere. But we also find willful suspension of disbelief by Utah non-Mormons when they're provided by information which contradicts the official position of the church. Now, the purpose of this talk today is not to say that Utahns or Mormons are more gullible than others. In fact, I think by the time we're through, we'll see that they're no more prone to this type of fraud than any other closed group. Affinity fraud is demonstrated in all numbers of groups across the country. And the most important element, of course, is exclusivity. Affinity fraud is not new. In the wonderful 1846 book, if you've never read it, Extraordinary Popular Delusions, by Charles McKay, he reports that the success of the 1600s British fraud called the South Sea Bubble was enhanced by the strict religious convictions of the prime promoter. The investment fraud, popularly known as the Ponzi scheme, was not invented in Utah. In fact, came to Utah quite late in its development. Multi-level marketing was not invented here. It was perfected elsewhere. Constitutionalists or sovereign citizens are by no means limited to Latter-day Saints. I first ran into affinity fraud as a lawyer in Alaska, and I was sitting in my law office when these two old people and the younger woman came in, and they had invested in a business known as World Plus. The ostensible business purpose of World Plus was to raise money to buy frequent flyer tickets from Fortune 500 companies, sell them to other people, and make a profit. The problem was that Fortune 500 companies don't have frequent flyer miles. They go to the employees that fly. Secondly, Mrs. Bonham was a convicted felon who had been convicted of embezzlement from the United States Post Office. Third, when she sold a frequent flyer ticket, she had to go buy it from another broker, and the people that flew on it had to lie about being related to the person who got it. And fourth, she offered truly outstanding interest, 125% every 6 months. She enforced exclusivity that you find in the Brigham Young story. If you didn't have $5,000, she'd send you away and tell you to come back when you're grown up and had that much money. She also had exclusivity because she sold to law enforcement personnel and other governmental workers. And when this came to me, the only way you could stop this thing was to file an involuntary Chapter 7 bankruptcy to spread the losses among the people. And when he did, you find that they invest by contract between the lender and a borrower, and that's not unique. In every Utah scheme we've ever run across, that's what they do. And numerous investors were really, really, really mad at me for stopping the scheme. They wanted the scheme to go on until they got their money. Then you could stop it. There are numerous investor meetings And when it came time for me to collect my fee, there were just a lot of people who were really mad about the idea that I was going to take any money out of stopping the scheme. And I was really amazed at the number of investors. This is Fairbanks, Alaska. Her headquarters was a bar outside of Fairbanks, and she had over 900 investors. And more astounding was the identity of the investors. Two state judges, FBI agents, state troopers, most of the local police force, and almost all of the employees of the Bureau of Land Management. And it was a classic Ponzi arrangement. She was using proceeds of later investors to pay interest and principal for earlier investors. The bankruptcy trustee, of course, came in and tried to level out the losses by suing the earlier investors, which resisted, and there's all kinds of litigation on that. Thereafter, I moved to Salt Lake City to attend graduate school, and I was then inundated by stories of Mormon Ponzi fraud. And looking to my Alaska experience, there's one thing that was just totally outstanding, and that is that in Fairbanks, in the borough there, which is the equivalent of a county, they don't have counties, there's probably 70,000 to 80,000 people, and there's probably four to 5,000 of those people who are Latter-day Saints. There's a large Latter-day Saint population up there. And of the 900 and odd investors, exactly two could be identified as Latter-day Saint. And one of those was within the Bureau of Land Management Affinity Group. And I think this demonstration of Mormon resistance to non-Mormon fraud probably demonstrates the nature of the affinity of schemes here in Utah. The Utah Department of Securities and the Securities and Exchange Commissions have for some years told the people of Utah that there is, has been, or will be $2 billion of fraud in Utah. That number is deliberately large, as well as should be, because what the authorities are trying to do is scare people. They're trying to scare people into being much more careful. I'll speak closer to the mic. I'm sorry. It's deliberately large because they're attempting to scare people. And that's well and proper, and it's as it should be, because if you scare people, perhaps they'll become more cautious. It's somewhat doubtful to me whether this works, because after 4 years of depression and mortgage failures, we still have alleged schemes continuing to appear in Utah courts and newspapers. There is some question as to what the number means, though, because is it Ponzi schemes? Is it only Ponzi schemes? We have the example of Jeremy Johnson, who's not been convicted, but is charged with running a $250 million, or rather ordinary, cheating of credit card holders across the nation. And is that included? Is the number expressed in constant dollar values, or is it accumulated? We really don't know. And what's more, there's a real problem in assessing the size of a scheme, and that is it the amount of money that is owed, or is it the amount of money that is lost out of pocket? There's a big difference. For example, in Bernie Madoff's scheme, by the time it was over, he owed $68 billion to various people, but when the trustee looked at it, people were really only out of pocket $20 billion. It doesn't matter whether someone loses their money to Madoff for a $5 million Utah scheme. Her money's gone in any event. But it's worth noting that the largest Utah scheme of all time was that of Val Southwick, who we'll talk about later, and his investors lost about $180 million. in that time period, there were over four or five Ponzi schemes nationwide in which people lost between Madoff's $20 billion to Alan Stanford's $7 billion to Tom Petters in Minnesota's $4 billion. And there's a lawyer, Scott Borofsky, have to give it to the lawyers here, that cost investors $1.2 billion. So the conclusion, when you look at the size of the schemes, is that the saints may want to cheat, but they're not particularly good at it. All the schemes we discuss are the willful suspension of disbelief based upon a group. And why would educated Mormons believe that a general authority of the church had a major league baseball career? Anybody that wanted to could have gone to any library in Salt Lake County and looked at a book called The Baseball Encyclopedia, which lists everybody that's ever played Major League Baseball, and it doesn't include Paul Dunn. The financial schemes involved the willful suspension of disbelief. In hindsight, who would believe the local leaders, church leaders, could give, in rural Utah, of all places, could give you better interest than you could get at investment companies in Salt Lake City? For that matter, why would educated people believe that the secret to world financial security is found in health juice companies whose product is largely apple juice? Why would well-meaning homeschoolers put their faith in the hands of an individual whose PhD comes from an unaccredited Baptist college conducted in the back room of a small Florida church? Why would anyone pay attention to a woman who received her PhD in health in psychology from that individual? She claims to be the world's expert on multiple classes of pharmaceuticals. Why would a group from Provo believe that they could escape their American citizenship along with the duty to obey the law and pay taxes by forming an Indian tribe in Arby's restaurant? Why would, for that matter, why would Utah ex-Mormons or non-Mormons believe that their friends and neighbors were dangerously mentally ill? Now, the purpose of this presentation is not to make fun of anyone, promoter or victim. What I'm trying to do, by relying on court filings, news accounts, and writings of participants, is show that Utah is in no way unique, but I do claim that any group, such as Utah Mormons or even Utah non-Mormons, can be led to disregard the warning signs that would come if the scheme or beliefs were promoted by a person outside the group. In the end, this is a cautionary tale. In America, there have been Ponzi schemes promoted by Jews, evangelicals, Scientologists, Catholics, and people like Ray Gene Bonham who don't have any particular faith. Everyone should beware because sooner or later, it'll happen to some group that you belong to. Second chapter, Mormons are crazy. In December 2007, a mental health group, Mental Health America, published a comparison of mental health statistics in ranking America's mental health and analysis of depression across the streets. The advocacy group indicated that Utah was dead last in mental health. And it didn't take long for this to hit the blogosphere. Brief sampling. Obedience, conformance, and maintaining a sense of harmony are unspoken but widely recognized behaviors which all contribute to what he calls the Mother of Zion Syndrome. Another one, ask a faithful Latter-day Saint why all the women in her ward suffer from depression and are on med. She thought that it was because they weren't spiritual enough. Interesting, this woman moved from L.A. to Orem. My emotional condition went downhill. I was visiting teacher for the bishop's wife. She was crying all the times I went to see her. Now I'm out of Utah, thankfully, out of the cult, not on meds, not depressed. Cringe when I hear these stories where Utah LDS are trying to pin the depression, suicide, and antidepressant use on anything and everything other than Mormonism. Based upon my unprofessional opinion and real life experience, there's only one reason for the high depression, suicide, and antidepressant use in Utah, LDS Inc. Continues on. The cause of depression was the one true church syndrome. No one in the church considers the beliefs are the cause of depression. One writer thought the problem was the church stigmatized the mentally ill. Quote, mental illness is king in Utah. Quote, a lot of the people in the LDS church slowly go crazy. But we have to look at this. And the first thing we have to look at is what kind of depression did the Mormon women that these people are reporting have? First, it was by women. Second, it was treatable by medication. Third, when removed from the situation, the depression went away. None of them describe mania, which is the telltale sign of bipolar disorder. There are no descriptions of psychotic breaks, which are found in serious mental illness. Though there's a claim of increased suicide, that's most often a male problem. There's nobody who talks about the increase in women, and nobody talks about postpartum depression. Women have more depression than men. Most reputable medical texts will tell you that it's a 2-to-1 ratio. Most people think that there's as much as 8% of the population suffer from major depression one time or another. It's kind of important when we look at this to distinguish between major depression, the big D, and minor depression, which we call the little B. I mean, we talk about this all the time. I mean, in our ordinary language, when we're sad or something bad's happened, we say we're depressed. Well, we don't mean major depression. We mean we're unhappy or that something's gone bad. The problem with the description of Mormon women as having more depression is that it's an external explanation. In other words, the church is making you go crazy. The problem with that is most people today think that major depression is an internal problem. It's a biological problem. There's a high degree of inheritance, heritability in major depression. And people today, when they talk about it, they talk about having a chemical imbalance. Those are all descriptions of an internal problem rather than external problem. It's hard, I won't go into it, but it's hard to diagnose depression even by psychiatrists. They don't have a blood test that they can run and say, you're depressed. They have a manual that they look at and say, do you meet 4 of 11 symptoms? And that's how they do that. Now, the judgment by Mental Health America that Utah was the most depressed state in the Union can be described as a social statistic. And what Mental Health America was trying to do two things, and they're very clear about it. First, the major problem that they had was this, in the time period that they were talking about, there was a problem called mental health parity. In other words, when you went to the doctor, your insurance didn't pay the same for depression as it did if you had appendicitis. When I returned to Utah in 1996, I went to quite a number of hearings at the state legislature on mental health parity. And Gail Rozica was there trying to convince the legislature that if they gave mental health parity, people would be faking all over the place, and which I never understood. The second problem that Mental Health America was trying to do was get more people insured. Now, I hate to say anything good about the Utah legislature, but the Utah legislature addressed both of these problems. In 2009, the legislature said that everybody with a major company had to have mental health parity. By 2010, they said that every policy sold in Utah had to have that provision. And then, after that, once President Obama's Affordable Care Plan was passed, Utah, sole state in the Union, with the exception of Massachusetts, established what was called medical health exchange, medical insurance exchange. And what this does is it allows individuals or small companies to come in and buy insurance at the same rate as major companies. And to this day, there's only three states, Massachusetts, Utah, and one other, which I forget, that have established such things. So whether the Utah legislature was listening to Mental Health America or not, they did what they wanted. Now, in looking at it's not Mental Health America, it was not the only one doing social statistics. The non-Mormons or ex-Mormons were also doing it. And in doing so, they weren't looking at the things that were going into the Mental Health America statistics or compilation. I've been reading, because I've had a case that I've been doing that deals with statistics, I've been reading the Federal Manual on Statistical Evidence. And there's two things that are important. One is, how big a sample do you have? And number two is, how do you ask a question? Because asking a question is slightly different. It gives you very different results. The federal government, the CDC, has these huge surveys that go on all the time. For instance, when we talk about children's depression, the CDC samples over 9,000 people, 9,000 children. The Mental Health America said 10.14% of Utah children suffered major depression. The CDC said that 3.6% of Utah children suffered emotional, behavioral, developmental problems. And that's better to, or equal to 37 states of the 50 states. There's other sort of statistics that you look at. For example, Mental Health America had over 10% of, actually 19% of adults suffering major depression. The CDC found the prevalence of current major depressions over 18 to be 8.7%. There are 16 states lower or higher rates of depression. Utah's rate is not only not out of the range of normal, it's not even worse. Mental health said that 14.5% of Utah had serious psychological distress. The CDC said not reported the prevalence of severe psychological distress and indicated that the Utah rate was not 14.5%, but 1.9%. And that's the lowest in the Union. There's some other statistics. The CDC had a pregnancy risk assessment where women self-reported. Utah's rate was 12.6%. There's reports from 21 states. Utah's postpartum depression rate was better than or equal to 15 in the reporting state. That leaves the major statistic, which is suicide. And suicide rates go up and they go down, but Utah's consistently 9th or 10th in the worst in the nation. However, you have to look at, there's a suicide belt in the Rocky Mountain West and in Alaska. And there's a lot of things that aren't in those statistics, which we don't have time to talk about. But the one thing that is that we know that 50% of people who complete suicide do so with firearms. And psychiatrists and psychologists in Salt Lake City and Utah say, if you don't have a lethal method, you'll probably get through it fine. But if you do have a lethal method, you'll probably end up killing yourself. And so when we look at these statistics, we see that there are conflicting statistics. We see that if we switch the question slightly, we get a different result. I just read in the paper, as you probably did, this month that Utah is supposedly the happiest state in the Union. I believe that about as much as I believe that Utah has the greatest mental health problems in the Union. Now we know, and I just want to do this briefly, we know that Utah, at least Utah Medicaid recipients, use by far less anti-psychiatric medications than other people do. And the reason we know this is because pharmaceutical companies can't help themselves by getting in trouble. In the 70s, Eli Lilly came up with the psychiatric drug known as Prozac. Prozac was the first drug that dealt directly with major depression or anxiety. It's a huge seller. First billion-dollar seller in the history of drugs. But by 2001, they had a problem because their patent was running off. And so they had to come up with a drug that would fill this financial need. And the first thing they came up with was they tried to sell it for Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's drugs are by far the gold standard. Anybody comes up with an Alzheimer's drug, it's going to make a lot of money. Problem was is that it didn't work. Second problem was is it tended to kill the elderly. They didn't stop there. They couldn't leave it alone, and so they went out and they sold this drug for everything from depression to probably hangnails.
What's this have to do with fraud?
This has a lot to do with fraud because people believe things based upon group affinity rather than perhaps the things that were available to them. Anyway, Zyprexa ended up in the Medicaid system. Once in the Medicaid system, the government got involved. When they sued Eli Lilly, they settled. When they settled, they had to divide the money. And they divided it not on population, but upon usage. Utah Medicaid usage, Zyprexa usage, was not 0.9% of the nation's population, as you would expect. It was 0.3%. It's not an anomaly. The sister drug, Seroquel's usage, was 0.037%, exactly half. Now, what was the truth? We should have known. Everybody should have known the Mormons weren't driving people crazy. In 2010, the Utah Department of Health said there's 32,415 people treated in Utah for depression. That's like 1.3%. There doesn't appear to be excess psychiatrists. There doesn't appear to be excess psychiatric hospitals. We define affinity fraud broadly to include beliefs reached through membership in a group. Utah non-Mormons are as susceptible as Mormons. They don't like the church or its leadership for numerous reasons, many of them valid. They're therefore willing to assume the church was slowly making their believing neighbors go crazy. The acceptance of this belief is no more rational than the belief that a former bishop in rural Utah has the ability to pay 100% interest on short-term investments. And credulity based upon group identity is not limited to one Utah group. Money from nowhere. Here's what you're looking for. Ponzi schemes, American invention. And there were earlier precedents. The scheme really came about with Charles Ponzi. Charles Ponzi in Boston in 1919 had the scheme based upon what's called a postal coupon. You could take a postal coupon from country to country and use it to buy a first-class postage stamp. And he says in the aftermath of World War I, there's countries whose economies are strong, countries whose economy is weak, and I'll be able to buy in the weak countries and sell in the strong countries. A couple of problems with that. He supposedly invested $15 million, which was greatly in excess of the $300,000 that the Postal Union reported in postal coupon sales. The scheme unraveled when it was disclosed when this was disclosed, and Ponzi went to jail. Actually, it's more interesting than that. He went to jail, he got out of jail, he sold swamp land in Florida. He was deported for that. He went back to Italy, and Mussolini made him head of the Department of Finance. We're getting there. Now, the signal feature of a Ponzi scheme is that a promoter like Ponzi and Mrs. Bonham uses later investments to pay interest and principal to the investors. That's done in order to make the scheme look profitable. And that's in every scheme, every Ponzi scheme there was, that's what they do. There's never been a successful Ponzi scheme because sooner or later the supply of investors runs out and the need to pay redemptions and interest will exceed the promoter's ability. And all that the promoter can hope to do, whether in Utah or elsewhere, is to live well, skim enough money, and disappear in Latin America. They're all based upon unusual business models that in hindsight look foolish. Another feature is the payment of high and consistent returns. Mrs. Bonham promised a return of 125% for 6 years. That's not unusual. Madoff never lost money. And there's also the element of exclusivity. While Ponzi schemes are not limited to victimizing persons of faith, that pattern seems to prevail. There's been an extreme number of Ponzi schemes designed to prey upon adherents of Judaism. Reed Slatkin ran a $500 million scheme aimed at members of Scientology. When caught, he asked for solitary confinement because he was scared of the Scientologists. The Foundation for New Era Philanthropy raised $500 million for evangelical ministers who thought they were investing in a building fund. There are intentional Ponzi schemes or Ponzi schemes where somebody just fails in business and doesn't stop, and then there's a great number of those in Utah. Ponzi schemes usually appear when economic times are good, and they usually explode with the coming of recession and depression. Madoff, Petters, Rothstein, and Stanford were all discovered after the economic crash in 2007, and the same is true of Utah schemes. After 2008, there was a dismal succession of Utah schemes, which came one upon the other. Unfortunately, the proprietors are pure Mormon. More unfortunate is the refusal to admit that there's anything wrong with running a Ponzi scheme. There's three examples I want to give you. Ms. Jill Skousen was a Republican candidate for the Utah State House of Representatives. Her platform was to get the Utah Department of Investments out of the way of small business, most particularly her husband's small business, who unfortunately stands accused of running a $100 million Ponzi scheme. He's not being convicted, but his company, Franklin Squares, offered a 60% return. Return was filtered through multiple layers. He advertised that his returns were safe, even though he made no legitimate profit in 2005, 2006, and 2007. The federal government charged Corbett operated with Founders Capital and other related entities as a Ponzi scheme to convince earlier investors that their funds were safe and earning money, and to convince potential investors that the program was working. And he obtained approximately $100 million and paid approximately $50 million in Ponzi interest payments. And just like Mrs. Bonham, Mr. Corber had prior legal problems. He's the subject of securities action in Wyoming. And just as Mrs. Bonham's investors were angry at closing the scheme, so were Mr. Corber's clients. They refused to come forward and identify themselves. Even sadder is the story of R.D. Uddy. Mr. Uddy was a Brigham City insurance agent, state president, and regional representative. His company, Strategic Assets LLC, supposedly invested in real estate, unfortunately, into a Ponzi scheme. Mr. Uddy said it was a $10 million Ponzi scheme. The government said it was $20 million, and no one's ever been able to resolve that. The judge allowed Mr. Huddy to stay out of jail if he was able to return investors' money. That's obviously impossible because no Ponzi scheme ever has. And the lack of shame when conducting Ponzi fraud against fellow church members seems unique in Utah. Travis Wright was the czar when caught his Ponzi fraud. He brought two rows of Eagle Scouts to observe his sentencing. The judge was not impressed. He was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. And it's not known if the Eagle Scouts saw the investors who lost everything crying in the courtroom. And the Utah schemes go on. Robert Nichols stole $5.2 million. He fled to the Philippines, was returned and sentenced to 10 years in prison. Wayne Ogden charged and convicted of a $7 million scheme in the 1990s and returned to steal $29 million in the 2000s. In June 2010, the SEC charged three men with running Ponzi schemes to target the Mormons. Their business plan was to purchase merchant portfolios or credit card accounts, hold them for a certain period of time, and sell them for a profit to banks. It's improbable as Mrs. Bonham's frequent flyer miles. In Colorado, former Mormon Bishop Sean Merriman pled guilty to stealing $20 million. He used the money to purchase fine art, classic cars, a motorhome, and a vacation home. He claimed to have traded in stocks and bonds, but like Madoff, did neither. The authorities found no assets. Philip Wachmauer Sr. ran a real estate investment company known as Valley Mortgage. He was convicted of a $30 million Ponzi fraud involving real estate in New Anna Basin, particularly hard hit for a senior citizen. He was a recidivist, having been sent to prison in California for securities fraud in the 1980s. Jeffrey Moen ran a Ponzi promise between 8% and 30% per month. He bought 200 exotic automobiles, traveled throughout the world. While awaiting trial, Moen solicited the murder of witnesses against him. And there are a number of other Utah Ponzi's. There's been a report of a large Ponzi scheme occurring in San Diego County. Again, this seems to be a scheme in which business got ahead of the owner. The schemer is described in the newspaper as being a farmer who simply let his business arrangements get out of control. It's not a very attractive record. One might note that rather than Mormon in general, the Ponzi fraud appears to be Utah, or at least Utah Mormon. Outside of Utah, Mormons seem to have earned a reputation for probity and honesty. We don't find any Mormons committing fraud on Wall Street or in the county scoundrels. We don't find them committing fraud in Florida. But as the recession of 2008 stretched into the next decade, the number and size of Utah schemes appears to have abated. It remains to be seen if this diminution of Ponzi fraud will continue when the economy improves. I have serious doubts. The Utah Ponzi scheme actually came late to Utah. I've searched the Mormon History Association files. No one's written on financial fraud of any sort. The term Ponzi is not found in Utah digital newspapers, nor have I found a scheme that looks like it. But when it did arrive in Utah, it was in a big way, and it was bad. Utah Universal Clearinghouse Company filed bankruptcy in 1981. The ostensible purpose was to raise money. They were going to pay off the company's debts early and get the prepayment bonus. That was their plan. However, the problem was there were no companies. There were no prepayments. It was a total Ponzi, total fraud from the very beginning. It's just a total Ponzi, total fraud. The bankruptcy court stepped in to ensure internal equitable treatment, and they found that as an intentional fraud, the scheme was insolvent from the very beginning. What we don't know about Universal Clearinghouse is the involvement of Mormon leadership. When I was in graduate school, I a paper on this, and I flew to Denver to look at this, look at the court records. The first bankruptcy proof of claim filed in the scheme was by Paul Dunn. I don't know, and I wouldn't say whether his name was used or whether he was an innocent investor, but it was very strange to me to find him and find him in such a prominent position. There's also Val Southwick. Val Southwick hid criminality behind a complicated interweaving of business corporations on the theory that if it was so complicated, nobody would ever figure it out. Mr. Southwick supposed, he had 150 companies. He supposedly invested in real estate. Some he did. We know he had some real estate in Las Vegas, which also went underwater. He also invested in Deer Valley. But the business pattern is so complicated. It's hard to tell what was fraud, what was legitimate investment. I've talked to the bankruptcy trustee. He says $180 million, perhaps in losses, perhaps more. The receiver has sued lots of the early investors for return of money. The receiver also sued the LDS Church, claiming that the payment of tithes constituted a preferential payment. And as in all of these cases, the church follows the policy of returning donated fraud proceeds. As a believer, I claim the right to editorialize about people engaged in Mormon Ponzi fraud. They should take no comfort from the Book of Mormon. In Alma chapter 4, we read that members of the church began to be rich, became subject to pride. In particular, they began to wear, quote, very costly apparel. In my mind, the modern substitute is multiple exotic automobiles. In addition, Alma teaches against the gospel of wealth. You're to impart your means liberally to the poor and feed the hungry. The saints were warned directly of the Ponzi fraud. Quote, and there shall be many who shall say, eat, drink, and be merry, nevertheless, for God you'll justify in committing a little sin. Yea, lie a little, dig a pit for thy neighbor, there's no harm in this. It's recorded by some of the authorities. The Mormon Ponzi fraudsters are the nicest people. That indeed may be true. However, their schemes, like schemes of any religious affinity fraudsters, have the potential of doing the greatest harm in the community. They destroy the bonds of trust and friendship that ought to exist in faith communities, leaving believers with nowhere to turn for safety. Bernie Madoff took money from many Jewish charities, including the Simon Wiesenthal Foundation. The supervisors of the Wiesenthal Fund felt like they had suffered a second Holocaust. The Mormon schemes will stop when the Mormon victims feel the equivalent loss and betrayal after having been cheated by co-religionists. In sum, we have to be real careful about not only where we invest our money, but where we invest our time and our beliefs. Utah is boringly normal when it comes to mental health. But when you look at the affinity fraud groups with respect to Ponzi schemes, it's very, very, very dangerous. And there's, as I say, in later chapters I'm going to discuss a number of places where people believe things just because they're Mormons, or they believe it just because they're non-Mormons. And what I say, having looked at these things skeptically, is that we all really ought to be careful about where we put our money as well as where we believe. Thank you very much.
At the outset of this paper, I found myself less than convinced that Mr. Street's inability to get Mormons to perform under contracts without recourse to Brigham Young, I found that to be a less than convincing example of affinity fraud, absent information about what lawyers call fraud in the inducement of contract. That is, unless the Mormon subcontractors set out at the outset of entering into the contract to defraud Mr. Street, I see only failure to perform a contract, not fraud. Why did they fail to perform? In their response that they would admire to see a Gentile force Mormons to fulfill a losing contract, I see hostility to Gentiles and possibly buyer's remorse about the realization that maybe they contracted for the short end of the stick. But I don't see anything in the example about that rises to the level of fraud. This paper defines affinity fraud early on in the paper as a deviation from normal business ethics based on self-identification in a closed group. While I guess a person can define fraud any way they want, in a paper, I didn't really find that a particularly useful definition. So I wanted to define fraud in legal terms. And I'm sure Ken does this, using it in a more loose way, but fraud is, you have to show by clear and convincing evidence that a representation was made concerning a presently existing material fact, which was false, that is, the representation was false, and that the representer either A, knew that the representation was false, or B, made that representation recklessly without sufficient knowledge on which to make the representation. And the representation needs to be made for the purpose of inducing the other party to act on it. And then you would have to show the other party reasonably acted on it without knowing of the falsity, relied on the representations, and they relied because they were induced to rely on it, and they did that to their damage. So fraud, by legal definition, is much more than Paul Dunn's puffing about his Major League Baseball career. Similarly, in the story about Miss Bonham and her failure to ensnaring Mormons in her scheme, he suggests that Mormons were immune to the fraud from outsiders. But I don't see any evidence to infer that at all. And in fact, two Mormons were caught up in the scheme. And so my suspicion is that to the extent that any Mormons were immune from her scheme, it was likely because they just didn't have contact with her, that they ran in different circles than she did, much more than any I don't know if you were suggesting this, but if there was any suggestion that because she was an outsider, they were immune to the fraud, I just don't have enough information there to infer that. Now, half of the paper was kind of with you. I thought it was really kind of irrelevant to the topic. 20 of the 40 pages were devoted to debunking the idea that Mormons have worse mental health than the nation. And while Ken may make a case that figures lie and liars figure, and that social and political groups have motive to manipulate the data to serve their own agenda, once again, I don't see anything fraudulent about that, and certainly in the legal sense. And at the end of that section, he says, we define affinity fraud broadly to include beliefs reached through membership in a group. And then he draws from that, the conclusion that non-Mormons in Utah are willing to assume the worst about Mormons because they don't like them. And I would have to suggest that a definition of affinity fraud that broad divests the term of any meaningful definition. And if that is a definition, then Mormons in Utah are surely the worst perpetrators of it, believing as they do that all other churches are false, that their professors are all corrupt, that their creeds are an abomination, and that they draw near to God with their lips, but their hearts are far from it.
Of which I would agree.
Yeah, okay. So the willingness of one group to think the worst of another is a topic worth exploring, but I thought it was tangential to the topic in the paper. Now, we get to the nitty-gritty of affinity fraud in the last section. And so we hear about Korver and Moody and Nickel and Ogden and a bunch of others. And this is the section that deals with true financial fraud. And it's what I expected to learn more about in this paper. And I thought of another fraud that maybe should be included if you revise this paper, and that is the spectacularly well-known fraud of Mark Hoffman.
Oh, yeah. That's I don't mean to interrupt, but
yeah.
Mark Hoffman was running a Ponzi scheme attached to...
To his documents.
And Mark Hoffman never got caught on the documents. He got caught on the Ponzi scheme.
That's right. And I was kind of going to say something like that, but now you said it, so I don't need to. Now, he treats all of these fraud schemes as affinity fraud, but I didn't find enough details in the paper to know if they really are affinity fraud. I don't even really know if most of the perpetrators were Mormon or to what extent they used their Mormon connections in order to perpetrate the fraud. And he made the comment, Mormons seem totally immune to schemes from outside of the faith and from outside the faith in the Intermountain West. And I thought, really? I just didn't find evidence of that in the paper. And actually, I don't know if you know about it, but there was a Ponzi scheme down in Southern California that has recently been in the news, so it's not just in the Mountain West. I also wondered about his comment that the authorities kind of inflate the numbers in order to get people to be more cautious, just to kind of induce some fear. And my take on that is, a lot of times, information about these fraud schemes come out in the very beginning. And the authorities charge them, and the press covers them, and they print the numbers. But at that point, they might really not know the extent of the fraud. They might not even have identified all the victims. They don't know how many people have invested. They don't know how much there is out-of-pocket losses, how much is owing, like he was talking about, because in the scheme, you get the money from the first investors, and then you pay them back with ridiculous interest that they could never achieve in a regular investment, but it's not, they're not getting it from an investment, they're getting it from later investors. And so you've got the promised interest, plus you've got the actual losses, and there's a difference in terms of how much the scheme is, depending on which of those figures you're using. I think is what he was saying. But I think that at the beginning you get this information about how huge it was, and then by the time they've sorted everything out at the end of the case, the press has kind of lost interest in it. So I'm not sure it's as intentional as it might sound. The title Slippery Treasures brought to my mind, at least, and probably to many of you, the image of buried treasures that Joseph saw with his seer stone that slipped away as people dug for them. So were you alluding to that?
Actually, I was alluding to 4th Nephi, where they hid their wealth.
Oh, okay.
And they were slippery.
Okay.
In 4th Nephi, that's...
And then I also thought that perhaps a discussion of affinity fraud among Mormons could begin either there or maybe with the Kirtland banking scandal, where you've got the leader of the church starting anti-bank after he's denied a charter to start a bank, and people lose a lot of money. Affinity fraud in Utah may or may not be the immense problem that we hear about in the news, but certainly to any individual investor, as Ken has acknowledged, is devastating. And so I hope that if he's going to expand this paper, that he would flesh out the last part of his paper that deals with the actual frauds that we've seen in Utah and look into how those people use their Mormon connections and whether they use their Mormon connections and do some analysis of what we might do as a cautionary tale to people to help them see through these things before they wind up committing a devastating financial or engaging in devastating financial investment.
Oh, thanks, Nathan.